From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The Israeli army is a powerful force, and commitment to the military a fundamental expectation of Israeli society. Tonight, we'll talk to an Israeli soldier and reservist who, after years of dedicated service, is standing up to that force and saying no to fighting in the occupied territories. We begin tonight with a look at growing friction inside the Bush administration over Middle East policy. Alan Cyprus covers the State Department for the Washington Post. He reports there is a deep divide between Secretary of State Colin Powell and other senior policymakers over how to break the Middle East deadlock. Earlier, I asked Alan Cyprus how the clash is playing out.
The main protagonists in this debate right now, on one hand, are Secretary of State Powell himself. And on the other hand, it's the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and some people close to the Secretary of Defense, including the Deputy Secretary, Paul Wolfowitz, and Doug Feith, who handles policy there at the Pentagon. There's some other players who are also involved, but right now the fissure really seems to run between those two departments.
And describe the fissure. What's on either side of it?
Well, the two institutions and the two personalities have been divided over a number of issues since the beginning of the administration. This isn't new. They've been divided over Iraq policy, over Afghanistan policy, to a certain extent, over arms deal, arms treaties with Russia. But in this particular case, you have one group, which is centered in the Pentagon with some support from the vice president's office, which says, first of all, you can't do business with Yasser Arafat. The guy is, if not a terrorist, then clearly in bed with terrorists, and that Sharon, as the Prime Minister of Israel, should be given wide latitude to pursue his military operations in the West Bank. On the other hand, you have the folks at the State Department and Powell himself who say, yes, we're not enamored of Arafat. But he's the only leader the Palestinians have. He's recognized by his people, and if you want to have a political process, you have to engage him. And at the same time, they say that, well, Israel has the right to go after terrorists. A military offensive as wide as the one we've seen in recent weeks is only going to engender more violence from the Palestinians and is also provoking a lot of anti-American sentiment in the Arab and Muslim world, and it's undercutting American interests out there.
So what is Colin Powell's State Department saying, privately at least, about the way the Bush administration handled Powell's recent trip?
Well, folks are discouraged in the department. They say they're as discouraged as they've been since the beginning of the Bush administration. Powell is remarkably popular among his troops. The loyalty they have is really stunning, actually. And so they feel bad for two reasons. One is they feel that the Bush administration, the White House, was not backing Powell up the way he needed to be backed up, in particular putting pressure on Sharon to cut short his military offensive. And they also feel bad not only on policy reasons, but because they feel like the boss is getting a hard time.
If Powell's hands hadn't been, I guess, tied by this conflict, What are you hearing about what he might have wanted to say to Sharon and Arafat, what he might have hoped to accomplish?
Powell went out there saying he was going to implement the decision of the president, which was to call on Ariel Sharon to end his invasion without delay, which Powell and National Security Advisor Rice both said meant now. But when Powell got out there, the White House, it wasn't as strong in its language as it had been before Powell went out there. He also wanted to get a political process going to start to address some of the Palestinian concerns, thinking this would help the Palestinians take stronger action against militant groups that are responsible for attacking Israelis. But Sharon has not been anxious to see this political process move forward. And Powell, again, the folks around Powell said that he didn't get the backup from the administration he needed to get Sharon engaged in that political track.
Is this just Powell's loyalists trying to put the best face on what might be described as a failed mission, just defending the image of their Secretary of State and leader?
I don't think they're trying to put a good face on this. I don't think it necessarily plays well in Washington to say that your leader is getting undercut or that he doesn't have support elsewhere in the administration. They'd much rather say that he's widely supported. This is, I think, just heartfelt discouragement about how American policy is being carried out in the region.
There are differences of opinion about foreign policy in any administration. Mm-hmm. So what's different about the squabbling inside the Bush administration?
Well, it's certainly true there are differences in any administration, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the differences here are more pronounced. You do have different personalities than you do in other administrations. But what's significant here is that the situation in the Middle East is as bad as it's been in a long, long time, certainly as long as I've been watching the region. And so there's a sense that there's more at stake.
Is there a fundamental divide in worldview then between the Secretary of State and the Pentagon people right now? Is there some beyond the details of the Mideast conflict, which represent a lot in themselves? Is there a fundamental rift in the way this administration wants to look at the world?
Well, there is. I'm not sure how much of that informs what's happening with Middle East policy, but generally, Powell is more favorably disposed towards engagement with the rest of the world, multilateralism. The Pentagon, the Vice President, and others in the administration believe that the United States has the ability to pursue its interests and shouldn't have its hands tied by allies or other countries if the U.S. sees it needs to get something done in the world. With regards to the Middle East, again, the State Department was more anxious to get engaged, to try to broker some kind of peace agreement than perhaps the Pentagon and the White House were. And that reflects the fact that the State Department hears from U.S. allies out in the Middle East, in the Arab world every day through the embassies, and they were hearing how American standing was taking a beating.
So the upshot, is this leaving Washington paralyzed as the Mideast burns?
There may be folks at the State Department who feel that way. I'm not sure that I want to say that. There are a lot of people in the administration giving it their best, trying to get, first of all, a resolution to the two standoffs we now have in Bethlehem and Ramallah, and then trying to get security cooperation between the sides moving and a political track moving. And if that happens, well, that'll be progress.
Can we get a resolution in the Middle East without a resolution inside the Bush administration itself?
It certainly would be easier if everyone agreed and the administration spoke with one voice. At the same time, you know, debate is not an unhealthy thing in an administration. And if this debate at the end of the day leads to a coherent American policy that can succeed, great.
Alan Cyprys covers the State Department for The Washington Post. Soldiers. That's all there were back in January, signing the declaration published in the Israeli daily Haaretz. Just a couple dozen soldiers and officers defying the mighty Israeli military, the imposing Israeli government, and all Israeli social convention by refusing to fight what they called a war of the settlements. The signers announced they would not fight beyond Israel's 1967 borders in order to, quote, dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people. And over the past 3 months, more than 400 Israeli soldiers have taken places by their sides. Tonight, we're talking with one soldier about his own personal decision to join, as they call themselves, the Refuseniks. Listeners, in a terrible conflict, at a terrible time, put yourself in the boots of a young Israeli soldier ordered to the West Bank or Gaza today. What would you do? Is this a time for following orders or following personal conviction? What should a soldier do when his sense of duty and morality collide? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to welcome Guy Grossman in the studio with me tonight. Guy is an Israeli officer reservist in an elite paratrooper unit. He was the 11th Israeli officer to sign on to the refusal to fight in the occupied territories. Guy Grossman, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're on a short tour of the United States right now. How long have you been in the country? How long will you stay?
I arrived on Tuesday evening, and Monday morning I'm back to Israel.
Back to Israel. Guy Grossman, we want to understand, before we get into the political developments that have enveloped all of us and you in a very personal way in the past few months, we want to understand your personal history. You're the son of Aliyah, of immigrants to Israel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was born in Ranana. It's a small town next to Tel Aviv. Both of my parents did Aliyah. My father came to Israel from England and my mom from Australia. I was raised in a very, very Zionistic home. My parents always told me that Israel is the only true home for the people, for the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. I was taught to love my country, but I was also taught to respect universal codes of morality, justice, and fairness.
You graduated at the top of your high school class and were soon into the Israeli military.
Yeah, it was obvious for me that I would go to an elite unit. In Israel, it's if you go and serve in a combat unit, you show your loyalty and your love to the country. For me, it was obvious that I would be fighting for my country.
What kind of unit did you end up in?
In a paratrooper unit.
Paratrooper unit.
Yeah, and it specializes in anti-tank missiles.
Now, we know that many Israeli young men and women, or is it all, serve in the military at some point. Explain the system to us.
Okay. Usually men have 3 years obligatory service. Women have a bit less of 2 years. And after we finish our obligatory service, most men continue to be part of the reserve military. We're supposed to be serving between 4 to 6 weeks every year on various duties. Sometimes we train and sometimes we are keeping line, whether it was Lebanon or whether it's the occupied territories.
And reservists are often called up. In fact, they've been called up just recently, have they not?
Yeah, definitely. In the recent operation, Israel actually called up something like 30,000 reserves. It did not do such a thing since the Lebanon War. It was an exception. We usually don't call up so many at once.
But in the big operation recently, they have been. You ended up serving for 4 years of active duty,
yeah,
including correct. 18 months in the occupied territories during the first Intifada and sometime as well in Lebanon.
Yeah, correct. I was about a year and a half of my service in the first Intifada and a few more times as a reserve.
Guy Grossman, we're going to get deep into the moral issues that you've confronted and the politics and the stand you've taken. But give us a sense, whatever sense you can, of your years in that service and how that backdrop, how that time helped lead you to the dramatic decision that you made not so long ago to refuse to serve again in the occupied territories.
Okay. During my obligatory service as a soldier and as an officer, I was a very determined, disciplined, and tough soldier and officer. I used to carry my commands and orders with very little hesitations. I think that it only maybe in the last year, just when I was before my release, I started to doubt basic myths. Or things that I consider myths today about our presence in the occupied territories, which made the service there a conflict, or a constant conflict.
What led you to begin to doubt what you call today the myths of Israel's occupation? What experience led you to that?
I don't think it's right to point an experience, because the occupation is not an experience, it's not a situation, it's an everyday reality. It doesn't have to be. I know people are always thinking, wanting to hear big stories, dramatic stories, very moving and touching stories, but actually it's a build-up of very small stories, the everyday life of occupation. It's a reality of 3.5 million people that live, Palestinians, that live without human, basic human rights, without the right to vote, without the movement of freedom of movement. It's the everyday reality of occupation. And a situation like that bounds to put you into days or situations that you will find afterwards hard to live with.
You ended up feeling, and you've written, that though you were reared on Zionist values of self-sacrifice and universal values of justice and human rights, you felt you were offending those in the occupied territories.
I think if you'll ask most of the Israelis, they will tell you that they don't want to be in the occupied territories. They are willing to give it back, but we have to be there. We have to be there to secure the lives of our people in Haifa, in Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem.
Do you agree?
And as long as you believe that you have to be in the occupied territories to secure the lives of our people in Haifa, you look at what you do there as a necessary evil. I think only when you overcome that myth, you cannot live with the things that you do.
We're talking with Guy Grossman. He's a refusenik in the Israeli reserves. What is an Israeli soldier's duty today? Can you understand the refusal of 400 Israeli soldiers, the decision of Guy Grossman not to serve, the refusal to serve in the occupied territories. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Israeli soldier Guy Grossman. He's one of 400 Israeli military men who are now refusing to serve in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They've signed a rather dramatic declaration describing themselves as combat officers and soldiers who've been on reserve all over the occupied territories and were issued commands and directives that had nothing to do with the security of our country. They say, "We whose eyes have seen the bloody toll this occupation exacts on both sides, we who sensed how the commands issued to us in the territories destroy all the values we had absorbed while growing up in this country, we who understand now that the price of occupation is the loss of the Israeli Defense Force's human character and the corruption of the entire Israeli society, we hereby declare that we shall..." Well, they continue that we shall not continue to fight beyond the 1967 borders of Israel. And the declaration goes on. Guy Grossman was the 11th officer to sign this document. The question is, what is an Israeli soldier's duty today? And can you understand the refusal of 400 Israeli soldiers, the decision of Guy Grossman, the refusal to serve in the occupied territories? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Guy Grossman, just before the break, you were talking about what you described as a myth, that the occupation, if I understood you correctly, is vital to the defense of Israelis and Israeli homes inside Israel, in Haifa, in Tel Aviv, in Netanya. Okay. How is that a myth? It seems widely understood that and certainly Ariel Sharon presents the case that the Israeli presence in the occupied territories is vital to that defense. You say that's a myth. How? Okay.
Israel is fighting two wars. One is a just war. It's the war against terror. And Israel has the moral right and the world support to fight that war. But there's another war. It's an unjust war. We call it the War of the Settlement. And we believe that Israeli governments for many, many years were taking advantage of the people's fear and ignorance for their political reasons. I'll give you one small example. After 24 days of invasion, of destruction, operation that we were witnessing in the last few weeks, our prime minister, in the interview or with a, came to the Israeli public with a sentence that said, "As long as I am prime minister, we will never evacuate a single settlement." That means he does not want peace. That means
he said this to senior Israeli army officers who were actually calling for, these are active officers who would be serving, who are calling for uprooting several dozen isolated Jewish settlements in the West Bank.
So if Israel wants peace and we all want peace, or we all want quiet, our presence there does not bring quiet to the area. We've been there for 35 years and we're witnessing terror after terror after terror. We're telling our people maybe it's not working. Maybe we need a different solution. We've been there all that time. We never left the occupied territories. We were maybe outside of the main cities, but we were always there. Yet we live in fear in Israel. Terrorists are exploding in our buses, in our restaurants, in the shopping centers, and we live in fear, and we're telling people maybe it's not working.
You say there are two wars. One, a just war, which you say you're ready to serve in any time, that is for the defense of Israel. The second you call a war of settlements. Why do you call it a war of settlements?
I call it a war of the settlement because the reason that Israel is not withdrawing of the from the occupied territories is because it has a settlement project which is trying to nourish.
There's no other reason. Several hundred thousand Israelis who now live mainly in the West Bank.
In Gaza, Israel decided a few years ago to make a big fence, a wired fence, and there's patrols there. In the West Bank, it did not do so. In the last 2 years, we're witnessing terror attacks. They all come from the West Bank. They do not come from Gaza. The only reason is because there's a wired fence and there's patrol. So if Israel really, really cares for the life of its people that lives in Hedera and in Netanya, the most reasonable thing we do is first to put a fence. The reason that there's no fence is because of political reasons, because we're going to draw a border, and this is something we could not tolerate anymore.
But wouldn't drawing a border be part of laying down a division that might enhance security? Are you saying that a border, the powers that be don't want to draw a border because they don't want to leave the settlements on the outside of that border?
No, we're saying something very, very simple, mm-hmm. that the only way to get true quiet in the area, or not a true quiet, a chance for quiet in the area, is to withdraw from the occupied territories and evacuate 100% of the settlement. Then I cannot promise there will be quiet. I cannot promise there will be total peace. But if we will do so, we will, and the Palestinians will keep attacking us, we will have the world's support and we will have our moral ground to retaliate. Today, as long as we're there, we don't have the world's support and we are losing our moral grounds.
Guy Grossman is one of 400 Israeli military men who are refusing to serve in the occupied territories. He was on active duty for 4 years in an elite Israeli paratrooper unit. He's now, with many, many others, a reservist who have recently been called up. And the question is, what is an Israeli soldier's duty today? Is this a time for following orders or following personal conviction in Israel? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Peter is on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Thank you. Before asking my question or my questions, I wanted to note that of the tens of thousands of reservists called up, I don't believe anyone refused to serve, and indeed 5,000 Israelis who were not called up volunteered to serve, and among those serving were some of the signers of the declaration that Mr. Grossman signed, who have changed their mind. Is he aware of that?
Let's just speak to that first, Peter. Peter, have some of the men who originally signed this declaration changed their minds after the events in Netanya and elsewhere and gone into the occupied territories?
Yeah, there were two.
Two. Mm-hmm. Duly noted, Peter.
Okay, and one more point just before getting to my questions, mm-hmm. which is I think that there are two loaded phrases. One is the word refusnik, which a number of the refuseniks in Israel now have signed a furious letter denouncing Mr. Grossman's use of this word, which they said refers to people who opposed the mighty Soviet state. Some went to labor camps. Some were killed. Mr. Grossman is making a tour of the United States, and they would prefer that he not appropriate their term.
Guy, your response?
It's something that a journalist called us like in the first week we came out, and it stuck to us because it was, we did not have a name till about a week ago.
All right.
I have no idea of this history.
It is an interesting point, Peter. In the rough and tumble of media coverage, things happen. But let's get to your main point, if you would, Peter.
I have four main points.
Four is too many. I'm sorry. Four is more than we can handle.
Well, okay. One is that in 1968, President Johnson asked the U.S. Military, the chiefs of staff, to appoint a commission to look into what was the minimum amount of territory Israel had to hold on to purely for security. And they issued a report, and this report said almost the entire West Bank, part of Gaza, and even part of the Sinai that has been given back to Egypt. Is Mr. Grossman aware of this report, and does he understand the concept of the marches, that is, the Roman marches? In order to defend yourself, you sometimes have to possess a little bit of territory, and here we're talking about, 2,000 square miles, not very much.
Peter, we've got it. Let me put it to Guy Grossman. We understand your point. Guy Grossman, as a military man, what about this assessment that Israel needs these territories at a minimum to defend itself?
Okay. Just about a month after we came out with our declaration, a council, the Peace and Security Council of Israel, it's a very renowned council. There's about 800 former generals that sit on that council. Presented the government their conclusion after 4 months of serious talks about the escalation of the situation, and their what they were offering or their suggestion was to evacuate, to start preparing to evacuation of the occupied territories. 800 generals in the IDF that think that we don't have to, we don't need the occupied territories to secure Israel. Rabin didn't think of it, and he was chief of staff, and Barak didn't think we need to have the occupied territories, and he was also chief of staff, and these are two people that care for the country. They would not endanger. So, and I think also about 70% of the Israeli population thinks that we could do very well also without the occupied territories. And maybe one point that I didn't stress, and I think it's important, if Israel keeps the occupation, that means we have 3.5 million people that live under military law. Israel decided, Palestinians, we decided not to annex the occupied territories because if we'll annex the occupied territory, Israel, we won't be Jewish because there's 3.5 million Palestinians live there. So we decided to keep them under military law. That means Israel might be Jewish, but it's not democratic. We look ourselves as guardians of democracy in Israel. You cannot leave people without human rights. The continuation of the occupation is not an option because it's immoral, because it's unjust.
Peter, I know you have more points, but we have so many callers that we're going to leave it at that, and thank you for your call. Daniel is on the line. Welcome, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
I just wanted to make a small point. I agree with almost everything Guy has said, but my point is, Israel is a democracy, and there are ways to make up your point. You can vote against Sharon, but you chose to do something to deny what you vote to do. So how do you justify the fact that other people are going instead of you to think they think to defend their country while you are not, and at the same point, how to reconcile the position in a democracy?
Got it, Daniel. We have your point. And Guy Grossman, this is the question of the soldier's dilemma. This really gets right to it. Daniel points out Israel's a democracy. A government's been elected. It's putting a policy into effect. Others are serving as a soldier. How can you, how did you come to this decision to refuse?
Okay. To tell me that in the name of democracy, I should perpetuate a situation with 3.5 million Palestinians living without human rights, and to do that in the name of democracy, I think it's absurd and I think it's cynical. I remind you also, Daniel, that democracy is not just the majority's way to impose itself over the minority. It's also human rights and the right of a person to refuse to do things against it that contradict his sheer essence, that contradict his most inner and most important beliefs. This is also part of democracy, that what makes democracy so beautiful and so nice, and that's why we cherish democracy. I also remind you, Daniel, as an American citizen, you remember the civil disobedience of the 50s and the 60s, the movement against the segregation of the blacks. They also were disobeying the what's so-called the democratic law. They were also shunned at the time, and I think we all know what important role they played in the Americans' democracy.
Daniel, thank you for your call. We have so many callers, I want to move right on. Robbie, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Glad to have you.
My question is as follows, that I think it's naive to think that the Israelis want to hold on to the West Bank. As Ross from the Clinton administration said in an interview on Fox News.
Dennis Ross, often a guest on this show, yes.
Yes, and what he said was specifically the following, that the deal that was offered the Palestinians was $30 billion for refugees to come back to a state called Palestine, a capital of East Jerusalem, 97% of the territories in exchange for peace. Arafat turned that down.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, so my first question is, the Israelis do not want to hold on to it, and they're willing to give it up for peace.
Okay, the second one quick, Robbie. We're coming up on a break here.
Second question quickly is, I admire the state of Israel for permitting you to come to the States to talk. I believe that you would be killed if you were a Palestinian speaking out for peace with Israelis, that many of the collaborators, so-called collaborators...
Do you consider Guy Grossman a collaborator, Robbie?
No.
All right, I just wanted to clarify.
No, I don't.
All right.
He would be labeled, if he was a Palestinian, a collaborator...
Is there a question there?
And hung.
Is there a question there, Robbie?
Yes, the question is... Who do you negotiate with on the other side?
Two good questions. Let's put them to Guy Grossman. Guy, first of all, Robbie says it's naive to think that Israel actually wants to hang on to the occupied territories. Your response?
Well, I don't know where he gets that information.
Well, I guess he's saying, look, it wasn't long ago that they offered to give up 97% of the occupied territory, so there's the evidence.
Okay. I don't have many good words to say for the Palestinians. I think the leadership is dragging the Palestinians into a situation that it will make them very difficult to get a state. The terror is something we have to condemn. I don't want to withdraw from the occupied territories because of the Palestinians. I want to do it regardless of the Palestinians, because I think it's immoral and unjust to keep 3.5 million people without rights.
But Robbie is saying, in fact, he believes that the Israeli leadership wants to withdraw from the occupied territories. You were suggesting earlier that there was ambivalence about this.
You know, it would be very difficult in our short time to explain to people about the so-called generous offer. It's just too complex in the time that we have. I'll just give one short story that will explain my point, maybe. Barak, before he went to Camp David, I remember it very vividly. He was climbing the steps. He turned to the cameras and he said, just before you enter the plane, give me 5 minutes with Arafat and I will bring peace. I remember looking at my mom. I was looking at my mom and I said, these talks are going to fail.
Why?
Because it doesn't matter exactly if you give 97 or 98. It's the intention. After so many years of hatred, it's the intent behind what you say. You cannot impose an agreement on the other side.
You mean that the giving away was not sincere, was not genuine?
Well, it's not an offer, a generous... It's not something we give. They live there. I mean, and we're not supposed to be there. It's not something that we just give.
Are you saying it needs to be a 100% withdrawal?
Yeah, of course. If anyone thinks that there will be an agreement without evacuation of 100% of the occupied territories, he doesn't understand. He hasn't been there and he hasn't spoken to the people there. We might impose such an agreement on the Palestinians, but it will be an agreement that will not hold. I've been to Hebron many, many times. If anybody thinks that the people in Hebron will agree to a state where they have to see every morning the red bricks of Kiryat Arba, he does not understand how the Palestinians think.
We're talking tonight, and Robbie, thanks for your call. We're talking with Guy Grossman. He's one of 400 Israeli soldiers who are refusing to serve in the occupied territories. What is an Israeli soldier's duty today? What would you do in Guy Grossman's position? Do you hear honesty or illusion in Guy Grossman's rejection of the Israeli occupation? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Israeli reservist soldier Guy Grossman. He served for 4 years active duty in an elite paratrooper unit, 18 months of that time in the West Bank during the First Intifada. Now he and about 400 other Israeli soldiers are refusing to serve in the occupied territories, not explicitly not refusing to serve the Israeli country within its borders or in other defense duties, but explicitly refusing to serve in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. What is an Israeli soldier's duty today? What would you do in Guy Grossman's position? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Claret is on the line. Welcome, Claret. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have one important question. I'm an African-American, and I just want to make one remark before I ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just want you to understand where I'm coming from.
Okay.
Because, when one has a conflict where you have an oath of allegiance, as in the case of this gentleman, and when it comes into conflict with moral conscience, which, you know, compel you to respect the dignity of human beings first. My question is, you know, why don't you, Mr. Grossman, support such plans which would develop the area there in terms of the clean water or infrastructure as the American Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche has proposed for the common good of all the people there?
Okay, so but let's go to this issue, and I guess let's take it down to this, and thank you for your call, Clarette. But Guy Grossman, I guess the issue is, what is there to your position or the position of the refusing soldiers beyond the refusal to serve? Is there a program beyond that about what needs to happen to bring peace to the area beyond simple withdrawal from the occupied territories?
We're not a party. We are a movement that is working in the civil society, and we're 430 people, and if you'll ask us about the solution, there'll be probably 430 different thoughts. We're all united in one thing that says that we refuse to serve in the occupied territories because it's endangering Israel, because it's endangering the long term security of Israel. I have my personal views, but I don't know if they're so it's that important. But we all believe that unless we withdraw from 100% of the area and evacuate all the settlement, there will never be a true peace. I just want to refer to the question of the other gentleman before, said about Israel being a democratic state, and I agree with him very, very much. That we can come out with such a statement shows the democratic nature of Israel. It's a strong society, a strong democratic society that allows different voices to be heard. And that was part of the reasons that I came to the state, to raise a different voice that people in the states, not just the Jewish community, also the American people, will know that Israel is not just Ariel Sharon settlements. There's many voices in Israel and many people that are still supportive of the peace idea.
Susan is on the line. Welcome, Susan. You're on the air.
Good day. Mr. Grossman, I have read your statement and the statements of many of your compatriots on your website. And I just want to say that although you are not the political leaders of the day, I really am the leaders of the day, and I thank you for your courage.
Thank you.
As an American, I think that we're not just outsiders watching something unfold many thousands of miles away. We have close emotional ties with Israel, and also the military support we provide makes us somewhat complicit in whatever happens. What would you advise Americans to do who want to show support for Israel, but at the same time want to support the rights of the Palestinians? What can we do to help?
Thanks, Susan. Guy?
Okay. Thank you for your kind words. I am telling people here during my visit in the States, I'm trying to sense to try and arouse that there's an urgency. In Israel, there's a battle on what Israel is all about right now, and we are urging people to raise their voice. You can support openly and publicly the peace movements in Israel. You can join a peace movement in the States. You can help finance peace movements in the States and in Israel, and you can send faxes to the American government and to the Israeli government to raise your voice. This is the time to tell people that there is a different way of reading reality. This is the time to be active, and I think you will find many ways to be supportive of the idea.
Guy Grossman, Susan, thank you for your call. Susan mentioned a website. Is there a website that your position is
explained? Yeah, we have
explained?
A website, www.seruv.org.il, and there's a lot of information about the group that people can find there.
Guy Grossman, I want to ask, you've written that what you call the second war, the war of settlements, is unjust, and you've said it saps my country's sanity and morality and corrupts its soul. What do you mean by that? What's the evidence of that?
As I said before, Israel is a strong and volatile democracy, but in the last few weeks we saw that the Attorney General is thinking of... Is he announced that he might put us on trial as treason, and 35 municipalities...
That is the refusing soldiers
and
put on trial for treason?
Yeah, and 35 municipalities announced that they will not hire people that signed the petition. And these are signs, it's not witchcrafting, but these are signs that you cannot keep a non-democratic entity behind the 67 border and think that it won't flow back to us. And as I said before, we want to be a strong democracy. We look ourselves as the guardian of democracy. We know that the only true democracy that we can have is being a Jewish state within the borders of 67.
We only have a minute left. Tell us about the reception that you get from your family, from your friends, from your neighbors, from fellow soldiers since you've done this. It's only 400 out of so many who've done it.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't the easiest time. I think the most difficult decision in refusing, I'm talking about the personal decision, is that you know that friends that served with you might sever their ties with you. Family members can argue. My mom actually published a letter in the newspaper which said that she does not agree with what I do, but she's very proud that she raised a guy, a boy, that is fighting for what he believes, that he's fighting for the face of the country, and she's very proud of me. But there's others that the family are not that supportive, and it's a difficult time for us.
And when Ariel Sharon says, we're not giving up any settlements, not while I'm prime minister, does it give you hope or despair?
No, it just shows me that too many calls for unity can be dangerous when unity is false. I will support my prime minister when he fights terror. I will not support him when he fights the war of settlements. Unity can be dangerous when it's misused.
Guy Grossman, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
I thank you very much.
You can read the Courage to Refuse petition signed by Guy Grossman on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. Coming up, nuns weigh in on the crisis in the Catholic Church. This is On Point. PrayTheNews.org was launched last year by an Indianapolis order of the Carmelite nuns to become more visible. Six sisters stay on top of the news and each week choose a big story and write personal reflections regarding the story. The results were far better than they ever expected, and PrayTheNews.org has gained national attention. We spoke with one of the reflectors, Sister Therese, as to how Pray the News began.
We began Pray the News when we realized that we really wanted to have more members in our community, and there wasn't the usual way to do this. No longer were sisters teaching in schools, so we wanted to become more visible. And to do that, we hired a real professional ad agency to help us, and they came out and met with us. Eight of them met with eight of us, and they said, well, what do you do? And one of reply was, well, for one thing, we pray the news. And after they went back and thought about it, they thought a website was the best thing that would enable us not to go out, but to let people come to us without disturbing our contemplative way of life. We have had a great response to our reflections. We've had, I think it's an average of 1,000 visitors per day, and we've only been on now a little bit more than a year. And what is so gratifying is that the people stay on. They don't just come and then leave. They seem to stay and sometimes ask to be on our mailing list or on our, we hope to eventually have an email newsletter. So it has maintained itself, and it seems like the readership is growing. We would like to be able to help people learn how to read the news. to not just read it and take it in as fact-finding, but to let it really inform them and inform that they can do something about it. We believe that prayer is an energy, and that if we can take these problems of the world into ourselves, reflect them, and pray over them, and put out some positive energy that maybe will help to solve these, that's one way to approach the news that's out there. It's become a ministry in itself, so I think that it will be long range. It's been very good, we think, for those who've participated in it, and it's certainly been very good for us.
Several weeks ago, on their website, the nuns reflected on the priests and pedophilia scandal. Here are excerpts of the sisters' reflections.
The church is a human institution. It is fallible. To live knowing that we are sinners is to live in the truth. Like all of us, institutions like the church succumb to the temptation to want to look good, to hide our sins and failings. We have witnessed much of this in the past several years. Watergate, guns for hostages, subversive help to the Contras, President Clinton's liaisons, and now pedophilia in the clergy. Governments, churches, and individuals who cover up wrongdoings that eventually come to light only worsen a bad situation. Thankfully, the church is now responding with honesty and humility. Two virtues we all need to pray for and practice.
This is Sister Betty. Some do's and don'ts. Do bring about justice with mercy to the guilty and their victims. Don't act as if all priests in the priesthood were sick. Do report a priest you believe is guilty. Don't forget to support the priests who are not. Don't equate pedophilia with homosexuality. Do realize that pedophilia is an illness, and that homosexuality and heterosexuality are sexual orientations. Do protect your children from abuse of any kind. Don't forget to protect those who may be falsely accused.
This is Sister Ruth. A few years ago, someone came to give us conferences on Scripture. She asked the question, "What would be the one thing you would find hard to forgive?" I remember my answer was the abuse of children. I think about that now as I read and hear the tragic reports of pedophilia committed by Catholic priests and the cover-up that has scandalized a country. I'm not sure I know what to say. What do you say to those innocent, trusting souls that were so wounded by the sickness of others, by a church that was at times more interested in its image rather than justice for the victims? I love the church. I couldn't imagine not being a Catholic. But I also know the church is a means, not the end. God is the end. Jesus Christ is the end.
Sister Therese, Sister Betty, and Sister Ruth are three of the Carmelite nuns of Indianapolis who write weekly reflections on the news on their website. To read other reflections by the Carmelite sisters, check out our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.